While we turn our Earth with giant diesel-burning machines, they turn their Earth with grass-eating horses. Somehow, their simple ways have enabled them to turn Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, into the most productive non-irrigated farmland in the United States. Now they are spreading out across the nation, buying farmland in 28 states. So comfortable are they in simplicity, their population has nearly doubled in the past 16 years. Speeding by on the highway, we look out the window at their work and think, how quaint. But down the road a ways, we pause to ask, why the Amish boom midst all our secular gloom?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 605th edition of the Food Chain Radio page right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Dover as tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford.
Hello.
Parmalee Taft.
Hello.
Karen Hauer.
Hello.
Folks,
hello.
They are on the move. The Amish have moved out from the heart of Amish country in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, to occupy farmland in 28 states and are actively shopping for more farmland. We, on the other hand, are in the midst of one of the most profound economic meltdowns in history. And so today we pause to ask, why the Amish boom amidst all our secular gloom? Here to help us dig for an answer, we have Don Krabill, who is a professor of Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College, also the author of The Riddle of Amish Culture and co-author of Amish Grace. Don, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you. It's my delight to be with you.
Anabaptist and Pietist Studies. Now, I haven't seen anybody out here in California studying those. They're more likely to be working with comparative post-communist politics or something like that.
Okay. Well, the groups that traced back to the Anabaptist movement, took place at the time of the Protestant Reformation in Germany. And the word Anabaptist means twice baptized or rebaptized, because at that point they were advocating for the baptism of adults, mm-hmm. and most of them had been baptized as infants in the Catholic Church. But the groups coming out of that movement are Mennonites, Amish, Hutterites, and Brethren. And in fact, you do have a number of Mennonites in California. Not any Amish, but some that would claim their heritage as Anabaptist Mennonite.
Mm-hmm. And what about Pietist?
The Pietist movement took place in Europe about 150 years later, in the late 1600s, early 1700s. And these were people inside the German Lutheran Church who felt it was emphasizing ritual too much. And they started a movement that also baptized adults.
Mm-hmm.
And so out of that movement came groups like the Moravians, various Brethren groups, such as the Church of the Brethren today, and you have some of those folks in California as well. And so we are at a research center here where we study these groups that come out of the Anabaptist Pietist movement, namely Amish, Mennonites, Brethren, and Hutterites.
Okay, good. Now, why can't I ever get an Amish to join us on the radio?
Well, the Amish are a communal group, not in an economic sense. The Hutterites have economic communalism where they don't have private property. The Amish do have private property, but they also are a collective group in the sense that they place the group and the interests of the community above the individual. And for an individual Amish person, to go in print with their name or to go on the radio or television would be a violation of the church rules and regulations, what they call the Ordnung. And it would be calling attention to themselves, acting as though they were the spokesperson for all the Amish. And it would just be unfitting because of the community's emphasis on humility, on deferring to the group and not putting yourself forward.
And thus, I was fortunate enough to find you.
Well, but I'm not Amish.
You're not Amish, no.
So it doesn't count.
But it comes pretty close. But we also have with us today Emmanuel Schwartz.
Well, and that doesn't count either because he's no longer Amish.
He's no longer Amish.
But we'll both help you out.
Okay. Emmanuel, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the food chain. I can barely hear you. Are you on the cell phone?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's go quickly to you. You were Amish, and now you're not. What happened?
Well, I was Amish until I was 17, almost 18 years old. And it was just hard to... I had a lot of friends that weren't Amish, you know, from working out, you know, in the world doing construction.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of friends, you know, my age, that weren't Amish. I guess it was the temptation is the biggest thing. You know, they had cars, radios, electricity, running water. I didn't have any of that. It's probably one of the biggest reasons. Yeah, at that age. But looking back, I think, too, a lot of it had to do with just, it's a lot, I guess it's easier to make a living when you have your own, you know, transportation and you don't have to hire anybody, you know, to drive you around or wait for somebody to make sure you're going to go to work. So I guess a lot of it's temptation.
Mm-hmm. So would it be fair to say you were seduced by the ways of the world?
Yes, I'd say that's very fair to say, yeah.
Okay, good. How many youth leave the church, Professor?
There are roughly, I would say, on the average, about 15% that mm-hmm. would not get baptized and join the church. I don't know if Emmanuel was baptized or not, but about 15% would not join.
Mm-hmm.
The other way to say it is 85% would sign up with a church, be baptized as young adults, or 4 out of 5 or something like that. So it's a very fairly high retention rate.
Well, let's go and talk a little bit about just exactly who are the Amish. You know, of course, most of us have an idea about the Amish from popular movies and whatnot, and we see pictures of them riding their carriages about in a time when the rest of us are zooming around in cars and trucks and airplanes and whatnot. So they came to America via religious persecution. Is that a fair enough statement?
Well, there was a lot of religious persecution and political turmoil and economic problems in Germany and the Alsace area of France and Switzerland. And so they came seeking to the New World, seeking religious freedom, good farmland, and economic stability. It was a combination of a number of things.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, they set up colonies, but the colonies, unlike a communalist, like the Hutterites, for people who have property in common. They're individual property owners, correct?
Right, they're individual property owners. I would generally not call them colonies because they lived interspersed with other outside non-Amish people.
Uh-huh.
They refer to outsiders as English because the outsiders speak English, whereas the Amish speak a Pennsylvania German dialect, sometimes referred to as Pennsylvania Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
And so they lived always, when they first arrived, close together but interspersed with English people. But they do have private property. Some of the distinguishing features are that they do not have meeting houses for worship. They worship in their home, meet every other Sunday. They use horse and carriage for local transportation, but a lot of them hire drivers for business work or long distance travel,
which is what Emmanuel was talking about. The difficulty.
Right. It sounds like he was working construction, and so an Amish construction crew would hire an English driver to take them, you know, to the construction sites and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, they use horse-powered or horses in the field to pull machinery, but they mount motors on the machinery. Men wear beard. They wear distinctive dress that varies. There are really over 24 different Amish subgroups, and each of them have different rules and regulations.
Mm-hmm. Well, you brought up an interesting point with respect to you have to pull the equipment with horses, but you can have a motor on the equipment.
Correct. They use the internal combustion motor, like for a corn picker or corn
mm-hmm.
planter. for a hay baler, for a harvester, and they use a very sizable horsepower engine that's mounted on the machinery, but it's pulled with horses.
And they can have roller skates, but they can't have bicycles.
That depends on the community. In Lancaster, they don't have bicycles, but in Ohio or Indiana, they do have bicycles.
Okay, they can.
So it's an example of how that varies considerably, the rules and regulations from community to community.
They can have, they can talk in telephones booths.
Correct.
But not have telephones in their homes.
Well, generally, the use of telephones and how telephones are employed varies, again, a great deal from area to area. In many of the communities, they're not allowed to have a wire line into the house.
You bring up the riddle of the Amish culture, and that's what we'll pick up when we get back from this break.
Okay.
Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking the Amish with Don Krabill and Emmanuel Schwartz, and you right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. Today we're talking the Amish. We're talking with Professor Don Krabill of Elizabethtown College and Emmanuel Schwartz, who is a former Amish and is today. Let me ask you, Emmanuel, are you still, do you still consider yourself part Amish or something now that you've dropped out of the church?
I guess it's still, I don't know how to, if I would really consider myself part Amish or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have the Amish background, but I'm not Amish. I don't follow any of the their ways other than, you know, the religion, but.
So you still practice, you go to church?
Yeah, oh, yeah. I still go to church. I mean, it's not an Amish church, but yeah, I still go to church. And
okay, so you're still there, kind of, but not really. Do you get to visit your family?
Very little.
Very little?
I get to see my family maybe twice a year for a couple hours.
Mm-hmm. Well, before the break, we were talking about some of the puzzling features of the Amish faith where, in some of the orders, you can have rollerblades, but you can't have bicycles. You can use motors on a plow or an implement, but you have to pull the implement with horses. It seems as though the Amish have made these interesting bargains with to get by in the world. Professor Graybill?
Yeah, well, in my book titled The Riddle of Amish Culture, I basically argue that the Amish have made a whole host of what I call cultural compromises where they've really negotiated with the modern world, and they'll say, well, we're going to keep the horse in the field, but we'll put the engine on a motor engine on a piece of equipment so we have enough of power. We'll have the telephone outside the house at the end of the lane so we can use it but not have it inside the house where it's interrupting our family life. We won't permit the ownership of vehicles, but we will permit people to hire so-called taxis, with neighbors provide them with transportation. All of those are in my analysis, these cultural compromises that actually help the Amish maintain their identity as a distinctive people while at the same time tapping into some of the resources of the larger world. So outsiders might look at them as inconsistent or hypocritical, but from a sociological standpoint, I think they're really kind of astute compromises that enable the Amish to keep their historic and religious identity, but at the same time tap into some of the resources of the modern world.
Emmanuel, when you were growing up Amish, did you have ways of sneaking into the ways of the modern world?
Yeah, I definitely did that. I was a bad child too. Don't get me wrong. I mean, every child, you know, as a child, you do things that you're not supposed to do. Mm-hmm. We'd sneak out of the bedroom window, you know, in the middle of the night when mom and dad were sleeping, they didn't know, and then sneak back in, or sneak down to the neighbors on a Sunday afternoon when our parents were at the get together after church. Mm-hmm. We'd go down to the neighbors, watch TV with them, or, you know. I guess seeing TV was something new. I mean, it was just really interesting because you didn't see that every day, you know?
Right, right.
When I was watching TV, somebody was talking to me when I was in the Amish. I wouldn't even hear them because my eyes were glued to that TV because it was just, I was in awe, I guess, with it.
And did what you see on the TV really hold a fascination for you and become one of the draws that pulled you away from the church?
I don't know if it was what I seen on TV. I wouldn't say it was that, no.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the biggest thing, like I said, was, you know, the lifestyle it's a great lifestyle. It was just a hard lifestyle to live. It was hard to make a living, hard work. I guess it's easier for me now to come in and flip a switch instead of have to try to fill up a lantern with kerosene and light it. Even at that, it didn't give you very much light, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, if I wanted to go to town, I'd have to go out and hitch up a horse and buggy and drive, take an hour to go to town. Now I can jump in a car, turn a key, and I can be there in 3 minutes, you know. So
and you made the conversion at the age of 17. Professor Crabill, what happens in that period when children make that transition from being children to young adults? There's a period of time there, and an interesting thing happens in the Amish ways with respect to those young adults. What happens?
Well, in many of the groups, when a child turns 16, then they can go out on the weekends with their friends and go to singings and go to youth group gatherings. And until they're 16, they're really at home on the weekends with their parents. And so this is a time between their 16 and until they get baptized or get married that they're a bit freer, and that's when some of them get into mischief, may have a car or go to the movies or go to beer parties or whatever. But as I said before, about 85% of them eventually will decide to join the church.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have a car, they need to put it away at that point. And then when they join the church, then they are expected to follow the rules and regulations of the church. So this Rumspringa, or it's a running around time.
Rumspringa?
Rumspringa, okay. Which is literally translated means running around with their friends, is a time for them to think about whether they're going to mm-hmm. eventually join the church or whether they decide they don't want to. Like Manuel did, and I'm gathering Manuel never joined a church, but left at that point. Or did you join the church, Manuel?
Yes, I did. I was baptized in the church.
Okay.
There's a difference then when you're baptized in the church and then you leave the church. What happens then?
Well, you get if you're never baptized, then the church basically doesn't excommunicate you and doesn't shun you. But if you are baptized, in some of the groups, well, in all of the groups, you would be excommunicated, and some of them have what they call bond and miting, which is a form of shunning or avoidance, so that you can't eat meals at a wedding, you know, if you go back. And I don't know, Emmanuel, what group you were in, but have you...
The old order.
In which state, or which, like, was it Swiss or Troyer?
No, I was... In Conneaut, Ohio, actually Pennsylvania was about Conneautville, Pennsylvania. We were an old order. It was a small community that came from New York, northern New York.
Right. So you would have experienced the shunning some after you left.
Oh, yeah, I do right now.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What does that mean, that you were shunned?
Like, I can't, my mom, she's having a rough time. I can't give her any money. She can't take anything from me. I can't eat at the same table. I can't help her out with anything. They can give me stuff, but I can't return a favor. I can't do anything
for them. Whoa. When you're shunned, the people who are shunning you can help you, but you can't help them?
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
How does that work?
It follows a biblical teaching that, I mean, the church views the person that left as someone who broke their baptismal vows. And so the shunning is designed to be a form of discipline to help the person come back. So they can help you because that's an expression of their love and their care and their concern for you. But they can't accept it back because that would put you up on the same level as they are. And there would be a number of Bible verses from the Apostle Paul that would be used to sort of provide the scriptural foundation for it.
So, Emmanuel, if your mother needs help, you can't help her, but she can help you.
Yep.
How's that?
But he can change that. He can come back. I mean,
if
he's willing to come back and confess, then he can be reinstalled into the church.
Okay.
They're viewing him as a wayward person that made a mistake. And so, you know, if he confesses, they would receive him back pretty quickly, I think.
Yeah, I'd have to make sure I've got rid of everything.
Right.
Modern, like everything I have that's not, you know,
All of your stuff. Hey, when we come back, Emmanuel, I want to ask you if you found what you were looking for when you left the church. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking the Amish. A group of people who are thriving in agriculture, in small industry, while the rest of us are having big troubles. Why are they thriving? Right back. Do stay tuned. Well, things are looking pretty dire out there in the world. It seems like all of these giant financial institutions are falling flat on their face, and yet there is one group of people who are doing quite well, so it seems. The Amish are expanding throughout the United States. Their population has almost doubled in the last 16 years. So we're taking a peek at the Amish today and asking why the Amish boom amidst all of our secular gloom. And we've got a couple of very interesting people. Don Crabill, who's a professor of Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College, also the author of The Riddle of the Amish Culture and co-author of Amish Grace. Also, Emmanuel Schwartz, who is with us today, a former Amish person. And Emmanuel, we understand that there's some big things happening in your life right now, right?
Yeah, I'm supposed to be getting married here next Saturday, a week from today.
A week from today. Now, will your Amish family be able to attend?
No, they won't. They won't attend anything like that.
Nothing like that. And the reason they will not is because you're being shunned because you left the church, right?
Yep. That's the main reason, I guess. I mean, I tried to, I sent invitations and everything to my mom and them, but yeah, they won't show up for anything.
Mm-hmm. And then Professor Crabill, you are a co-author of a book called Amish Grace, How Forgiveness Transcended Tragedy, which of course is the story of the incredible forgiveness exhibited at the school shooting in the Amish community. But where is the forgiveness here? And this kind of leads us into the whole notion of how on earth does the Amish community hold itself together in the face of such an incredible onslaught of popular culture? First question is, why no forgiveness for Emmanuel for leaving?
Because he is a member of the church. He made a baptismal vow on his knees before God in the community, and he broke that when he disobeyed the rules of the church. And so there is forgiveness for him if he repents, but repentance must precede it. In the case of the schoolhouse shooting, this was an outside person who had not pledged to be a member of the church, had not taken a baptismal vow, and so the justice in that situation for this outsider was handled by the state. It would be handled by the state courts and so on. Now, it turns out that shooter of the children in the schoolhouse killed himself, but the Amish would see forgiveness there as being they are forgiving him for the wrong he did to them, but justice and holding him accountable is a responsibility of the state, not the church. In the case of someone like Manuel, then they see justice being the responsibility of the church because it's someone who is a member of the church. So that's why it would look different. And in the book, Amish Grace, we have a whole chapter where we deal with specifically this question.
Emmanuel, what do you think about that? I mean, do you think there's that's an equitable position for your family to take, or do you want forgiveness for leaving the church?
It's very difficult. I mean, even being born and raised in the Amish, it's hard to understand, you know, the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know, I understand they shunned me because I was baptized in a church, and I was 16 years old when I got baptized. So I guess I could say, say that I knew what I was doing. But at the age of 16, I still didn't understand all the...
You were still sneaking out the second story window, weren't you?
Yeah, pretty much, yep. Uh-huh. And I got baptized basically because my parents were like pushing me to. They wanted me to. I did it to make them happy. Mm-hmm. If I'd had to choose it, to do over and choose, I would have waited to see what I wanted to do in life. I think at 16, you're not old enough and responsible enough to figure out exactly how you want to, you know, where your life's going to go.
Well, so that means that you did not take part in the ritual of, what did you call it, Professor, running around?
Right, Rumspringer, running around.
Rumspringer.
Yeah, his case is somewhat unusual. Typically, young people wouldn't get baptized till they're, maybe some of the girls at 18, but often the boys would be 19, 20, 21 or so, right before they're married.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this leads me to my next question then. How do the Amish hold themselves to the old order, the old ways, in the face of this tremendous onslaught of popular culture that, you know, reigns in upon them from every direction?
Well, there are several things. They emphasize separation from the world as a biblical principle, and so they don't have television, don't have radio, aren't going to the movies, they're not using computers, so they're basically cut off from the electronic media of the culture. Secondly, they don't go to high school. They 90% of them are going to a one or two room Amish school. So they're not exposed to outside secular values there. And in addition, you know, as we've been saying, once they are baptized, they're really held accountable to the church. And if they leave, there are consequences for that, as, you know, as we see in Emmanuel's case.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those things work together, you know, to help them have a fairly strong community that's able to maintain a reasonable degree of separation from the outside world. Now, they engage economically with the world. They're buying and selling and trading products, and Amish businesses are selling, farmers are selling their products. So it's not like they're completely isolated. There's a lot of day-to-day contact, but in terms of things like education and television and computers and other electronic media, they are somewhat cut off.
Wow. So you're living right in the middle of this popular culture, and yet they're somehow managed to maintain a separateness about them. What about splinter groups? Let's say, you know, one group of Amish decides that we need to have bicycles.
Right. It happens. As I had said earlier, there are over 24 different Amish groups. Now, the ultimate authority is in the local church district. There are some 1,700 different local congregations, and the ultimate authority for those decisions are basically at the local congregational level. So even in a subgroup where you might have 100 congregations that fellowship together, there may be some variation there because the local district may decide they're going to accept bicycles or accept cell phones or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Emmanuel, you talked about leaving the church at a very early age, 17, admitted to being seduced by the ways of the world, as it were, and going out there. And what did you hope to find when you went out into the world?
You know, that's hard to explain.
I'll make a deal with you. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll...
I think he was looking to find a wife, and sounds like he found one.
All right.
Well, I guess that would do it. That happened, but...
we'll pick that up when we come back, folks. We're going to take a quick break. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today, we're talking the Amish ways, and we're wondering why the Amish are thriving in a world that seems to be barely surviving. What's going on here? Why are they turning this entire Lancaster County into this incredibly fertile field of agriculture? Why are they spreading out across America? What is it that gives them such incredible strength and the ability to move? We're talking Amish ways with Don Krabill, professor of Anabaptist and Pietist Studies, and Emmanuel Schwartz, a former Amish person himself. And you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Join us. Well, I'm looking at this incredible story, The Riddle of Amish Culture, and I just ran across a photograph of a young couple in an open courting buggy. Why is the courting buggy an open courting buggy, Professor Krabill? Oops, better press the button here. Hold on. There you go. Did you hear that one, Professor Krabill?
Yes. I'm not sure I have a good answer to the question. It is a long-standing tradition in Lancaster County that the courting buggies are open.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know historically why that developed.
Okay.
I would say in some other settlements, all of the buggies are open. Some of the Swiss groups in Indiana, for example, the carriages are always open. So carriage style like that varies from community to community.
So, Emmanuel, having left the church at 17, did you miss courting in an open buggy?
I never did court any Amish girls.
Uh-huh.
And I was, before I did leave the Amish, I was courting a girl an English girl, actually. And that was probably one of my big reasons.
Oh, Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, that's probably one of my big reasons for leaving the Amish. I mean, that was...
Yeah, I knew. I told you. He was looking for a wife.
Well, that's good enough. Quick question from a bunch. One, what about, do the Amish pay taxes?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay, so they're in the world.
The only things they don't pay that we would consider taxes are Social Security taxes.
Oh.
If they're self-employed or if they work for an Amish employer, they are exempt from Social Security. They're outside the Social Security system because of a U.S. congressional ruling in the 1960s.
Because they don't draw Social Security.
Correct.
Huh.
And in some states, they also don't pay workers' compensation because they provide their own insurance if members are injured on the job.
You know, in looking around, I ran across a quote from a government official who had a bunch of Amish move into town, and the reporter asked him about the Amish, and he said, well, I don't really know much about them at all. They don't send their children to school. They don't... they're never in trouble, and they don't need any long-term assistance, so we really have very little contact with them. I guess if anything says it. One more quick question before we go to the phones, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. What about the incidence of autism and mental illness among the Amish? Professor Krabill?
Yeah, there are cases of mental illness. There are a number of mental health care facilities that work with Amish patients. Here in Pennsylvania, we have one that's attached to a psychiatric hospital.
Mm-hmm.
On the question of autism, I can't answer that. I don't know.
Okay.
And Michael, I need to leave in about a minute.
Okay, then I want to ask you a quick question. Why are the Amish thriving?
The Amish are thriving because for several reasons. One is they have sizable families of 6-7 children on the average, and they're able to retain 85% of those, And secondly, they have developed clear-cut guidelines for how they interact with the outside world. So it's both their internal population growth and their ability to create regulations for how they interact with the outside world that I think have enabled them not only to survive, but actually to thrive in a modern world.
Okay. Professor Krehbiel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Enjoy reading The Riddle of the Amish Culture and look forward to Amish Grace. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now we get to go to the phones, but you don't get to play, but we're going to miss you. Let's go quickly to Rob. Rob, welcome. Robbie, welcome to the food chain.
Is Irving still there?
Irving? Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, is Irving still there?
Irving.
Yeah, the Amish boy.
Emmanuel is still
Emmanuel,
there.
Emmanuel, I'm sorry.
Yes. Go ahead.
Grace Good, Emmanuel.
How was that?
Grace Good. It's German for God's grace.
Oh, yeah.
Emmanuel, do you still speak German?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Okay. But he probably hasn't heard it in a long time. And
well, there's a lot of different Germans, though.
Yeah, their German is an old German.
Yeah, there's a high German, there's low German, there's Pennsylvania Dutch, there's... I'm more a Swiss German mix.
Okay.
And there's also the German I flunked in high school.
I was stationed in New Jersey when I was in the military, and I used to go over to Lancaster County and stay with Amish family sort of as a house guest. And I will tell you this, Mike, it was some of the finest food I ever had in my life. And a number of things impressed me. For instance, in their homes, they used candles and kerosene lamps and so forth. But in the cow barn, they used electric milking machines and electric lights.
Yeah, there's that irony. Robbie, why do you think that the Amish are thriving?
Because they stick to the basics. You know, this big Wall Street crash and so forth really doesn't affect the basics of our economy. We could still trade produce for various items. You could take a bushel of corn and trade it for some kerosene.
My cabbage for your potatoes, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the money part of it is really not necessary for a good life.
Oh. Well, there you go. Robbie, thanks for the calls. We're going to have to take a quick break. What do you think, Emmanuel? The money is not necessary for a good life?
That's very true. I mean, they don't need as much money because of the fact they do have big gardens. They can everything. They butcher their own, they raise their own beef or pork, and they butcher, and they can all that. So.
Right back. Do stay tuned. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Last break coming up. Well, I came up with a little irony this morning while taking a shower and thinking about this show and thinking about the Amish people. They are a people who give up their self first to the church, then to the family, then to the community. And in that selfishness, selflessness, is quite different than us who live in this secular world where the individual is everything and everything else comes first. And then I look at how the Amish selflessness has enabled them to become independent people, not needing of us. And then I look at how our individualism here in the secular world has led us to become all totally dependent on the outside world. And I just think that there is an irony there that is kind of strange. Emmanuel, do you ever think about that?
I don't know. It's just the Amish, they like trying to stay as away from the modern stuff as much as possible, mm-hmm. you know? And I don't know how to...
Emmanuel, did you find what you were looking for when you left the church?
Did I find what I was looking for?
Yeah.
I guess I could say I did, yeah. I make a good living, got a nice house, got a beautiful fiance I'm going to marry here in less than a week, so yeah, I could say I found what I was looking for. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's there's a lot of hard times with it, you know, not being able to see my family or not having them to my wedding or anything like that. But, yeah, I can say I found what I was looking for.
Good. Let's go quickly. Oh, one more question. Are the Amish in their family settings affectionate? Do they hug their children?
Absolutely. Very affectionate.
Okay, good. Let's go to Rory. Rory, welcome to the food chain.
Thank you, Michael. Hey, I just wanted to say that on the issue of autism amongst the Amish, I heard an interview with a fellow, and it's probably something you could find online, but apparently they have none of their children born in the communities have autism because they don't vaccinate.
Hmm.
The only cases of autism are kids that were vaccinated outside and kids that they adopted.
Rory, so Emmanuel, do you have any experience with that?
I don't think that's true. There is autism kids. I mean, you don't see as much, but it's almost
negligible.
Rory, let me ask you quickly, why are the Amish thriving?
You know, Michael, they're sticking to the old traditions of living within your means. And, yeah, they might be a little legalistic in some areas, and they might seem inflexible. But overall, their plan is very effective because they don't go into debt. As I mentioned to you earlier, in the Midwest farm economy crash in the 80s, the Amish were buying property. A lot of them moved out of Pennsylvania, and they moved into the other states in the upper Midwest, the Ohio Valley, and bought property because it was a fire sale, and they had what?
Cash.
Huh. So they're smart operators. They're careful. They're the go slow. Slow is fast when it comes to the Amish and in life in general. So I my hat's off to them. I am not in that realm, but with my family, we probably practice similar philosophical approaches to life.
Emmanuel, what do you think? Do you miss being an Amish?
Oh, there are things that I miss about it. Don't get me wrong. Sometimes it's a better lifestyle. It's less hustle and bustle, you know. It's more relaxing.
Uh-huh.
Don't get me wrong, it's a lot of hard work. But
hey, Emmanuel, thank you for joining us today on the food chain, and thank you all out there. We're out of time, but not out of thoughts. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio on the food chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.